My name is David Livingston. I'm the author of 5 books studying the history of the occult. And my most recent is Ordo Ab Cal, which is very much a culmination of the research I've been doing for about more than 30 years now. I'm pretty surprised of how much I've tried to be thorough in all these years and thought that I had covered these topics in quite some detail. In my first few books, I was surprised to find out how much I discovered. I was still able to discover, to put forward in my recent books. So, Ordo Ab Cal is Latin for order out of chaos, and it's the motto of Scottish Rite Freemasonry. And what it appears to represent is Albert Pike himself, who revealed that the goal of Freemasonry, of course, Freemasonry, the reason they call themselves Masons is because they are bricklayers who are laying the bricks for the rebuilding of the Third Temple of Solomon, the third iteration of the Temple of Solomon, which is expected to be an important milestone in the end times events. And so what they're trying to do is they're trying to effectively fulfill the Book of Revelations. And so as the Book of Revelations describes chaos taking place before the advent of the Messiah, they believe themselves required to produce that chaos in order to accelerate his arrival. So order out of chaos effectively means that. It means pretty much the New World Order, that they are trying to bring about the outcome of through the sowing of chaos.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it, that quite a lot of the people now, politicians particularly, always get the blame, although they don't really seem to have much power these days. They seem to be more like front men for other forces, maybe banking, arms, these kind of things. Is that a lot of people say, well, these people are rubbish, they're useless, they're mad, but actually maybe there's a purpose. Maybe there is a purpose behind this chaos that we're seeing, particularly in the Western economics. I mean, look at, for example, this situation we've got in our economy in Britain now. I'm not sure how things are in Canada, where there is really no reason now to work as a very poor person, unless you're sending money abroad, that work is no longer a route out of poverty. It's almost as if this whole idea of going and doing a unskilled, low paid work is not valued at all anymore. But that, that's sowing its seeds of chaos in society. A lot of youngsters going into organized crime, for example, as a result of it. But you're saying that maybe there's a purpose to this chaos?
Yes. I mean, those are pretty specific examples, but the chaos is so much. It's the wars, it's the demoralization of society, it's a disease, poverty, murder. Of course, the slow elimination of Christian influence, of pretty much any major influence of any major religion. So all those elements are all part of the complete deterioration, corruption of society is the perceived to be the means for accelerating the coming of the Messiah, which is why a lot of these modern sort of accelerationist neo-Nazi organizations, they're carrying out these various acts of terror to contribute to the mayhem.
Well, yeah, not least of which, of course, is over in the east of Ukraine. There's a lot of murder going on there, and a very strange attitude by the Western intellectuals, supposed intellectuals, who are saying, well, Ukraine has got to win. Well, actually, no, Ukraine has already lost. So the idea that, Ukraine has got to win is just going to mean more death and destruction. But look, David, I know you've just put together what I found an absolutely fascinating read about the links between psychedelics and fascism. Do you want to just start us up after the Second World War, because I know most people will have heard of MKUltra, and that's, I mean, although you don't actually start the article there, let's start there just by looking at and trying to understand what MKUltra was about and why it might be linked to the fascists.
Okay. It's hard to explain what it is without some background, but where to start? So, I mean, So MKUltra, of course, was a program of the CIA. It actually grew out of the cybernetics program. And the cybernetics program was headed by the Macy Foundation, which was another CIA Rockefeller front. And it was linked to the study of schizophrenia. So they were trying to try to find ways to emulate the symptoms of schizophrenia. And so it's perceived to be a mind control, quote unquote, program, which doesn't really quite accurately describe it. There's a sub project of MKUltra, and you can find it online. It's a CIA document that details exactly how what they describe or what they plan to do. And it's pretty astounding because I've never seen anything that is such an open confession of the brutality of what they were trying to do. So basically, they described it that they were trying to create MPD, right? Multiple personality disorders in children. And to achieve that through the combination of torture, through electric shock, and drugs. So this is what's commonly, you know, referred to in conspiracy literature as, it's related to ritual trauma, right? Satanic ritual trauma. So it's the same idea that it's been described as creating altars. And so effectively, the way that I understand it is that if you put a child through horrific situations that they're not able to cope with, then they retreat to a part of their mind. And it allows, it's my guess, that it allows demonic entities then to possess them. And that's what, there's a more, clinical approach to which tries, again, to describe them as personalities or alters, but that's really what it is. And then those personalities, and then they control through hypnosis. So, yeah, basically the CIA tried many drugs. They tried, they tested marijuana, they tested peyote, they tested mescaline. And finally, they settled on mescaline, which was discovered by a Swiss scientist, Albert Hofmann. I'm not sure what the year was, 1932, 1938. And then finally designated by the CIA to be the drug of choice that they were going to use for their program. So basically, the real head behind that is Aldous Huxley. He's the guy who really inspired it. So it's important to note that he wrote Brave New World, which is about a society and a dystopian view of the future of a tyrannical society that uses drugs and promiscuity to control its population. And this is a point where we can get back to what the background of this really is, because it's occultism. He named the drug Soma, and the Soma is a name that's found in the Vedas, because it refers to the drugs that were apparently, to make a long story short, used by the ancient shaman. There's another drug called the Haoma, and which was used by the ancient magi for their ritualistic purposes. Nobody knows really what that is, but MKUltra effectively is these occultists using the vehicle of a governmental intelligence organization, the CIA, to carry out experiments to achieve the results that they believe through their occult understanding that would probably be possible to achieve, effectively, as they described it, ESP in children.
Well, I mean, look, this use of hallucinogenic drugs particularly does go back a long, long way, right back into the roots of witchcraft and things like this in Europe. The use of the psychedelic mushrooms and things like this by witches is actually quite well recorded. And so maybe there's something going on at the CIA, which is actually a throwback to these sort of almost maybe even pre-Christian days.
Yeah, well, that's why it comes from an occult belief, right? So this is not what you're saying is not going to be news to Aldous Huxley, right? Huxley was a firm believer in what's called the perennial philosophy. So he believed in this whole idea, really popularized by René Guénon, of a single esoteric tradition that links all of the, which is the core of the, sorry, a single occult tradition, which is the core of the various esoteric traditions of the of the exoteric religions. So that's what it comes down to. It's the belief in achieving. This is why they described it. This is why they, you know, the whole purpose of occultism is to make contact with entities, right? And black magic is the performance of various rituals to make contact with these entities and then to either gain knowledge from them or to use them to carry out acts in your favor. So that's why it's regarded that the shamans are so-called these ancient witch doctors. This is what they did. And so they, what would happen to them is for various actions that they would perform, they would achieve a trance state, which is much normally, you know, understood as being a state of demonic possession. So for these occultists, well, the way they translate it into modern clinical language is as schizophrenia. And so schizophrenics basically experience the same thing, for the most part, are victims of psychic attack. Usually they hear voices and things like that, and which is, again, an example of a demonic activity. So, again, this is how occultists view it. So this is why they described it for the rest of us as schizophrenia, but yeah, they understood it as trying to emulate the trance states of the ancient shamans, which they knew was partly achieved through drugs.
Well, isn't it interesting, the sort of almost tug of war that's gone on between people of the Judeo-Christian religions mainly, but also the kind of psychiatric profession pulling in the other direction, just poo-pooing this idea of demonic possession?
Yes. I mean, the thing is, there's a fascinating history about how even the field of psychology itself grew out of the study of occult phenomena. If you look at the founders of the field of psychology were mostly linked to the study of trying to prove psychic abilities. A lot of it had to do with also the study of ectoplasm. I don't know if you know what that is, but a lot of times people in trance states or, you know, produce this substance which is referred to as an ectoplasm. It's popularized in the Ghostbusters movies as a slime. But you can see that there's various photographs that they took of this material. But then what's strange is that you get this simultaneous outgrowth of what's called the Society for Psychical Research, I think is what it's called, which involved, what's curious is that it involved a lot of people who were deeply connected to theosophy, but they ended up supposedly disproving or, you know, proving Blavatsky to be a fraud. But so I don't know how it exactly happened, but basically it grew out of that, but then sort of developed this scientific empirical look at the world that purportedly rejected the existence of the supernatural.
Well, I mean, it's hilarious, isn't it, if you think about it, that these psychiatrists are actually founded on occultism, and yet they deny it. But so, you know, no wonder they're a bit, some of them are a bit messed up. But anyway, yeah. Look, let's also have a look at how this use of drugs. I mean, fascism, we think of really, I suppose, as a 1920s Italy and 1930s Germany. That's where, that's where we think of as fascism. Were the Nazis into psychedelics? Were the Italian fascists into them?
Yeah, so it appears that the Nazis basically were discovered LSD first. And so like everything else that they imported from the Nazis after the war, the CIA basically just took over the project, brought over those Nazi scientists. And MKUltra was effectively a continuation of the projects that had already been begun by the Nazis. And so, you know, this is why you find this intersect. I mean, where it all goes back to is that they believe, so what they follow, it goes back to the idea of Shambhala and Agartha. So Blavatsky was the woman occultist who popularized the idea of Shambhala. And of course the Nazis were sending exhibitions to Tibet to try to find Shambhala, right? It's also a legend that's interchangeable with Agartha, which was popularized by Saint Yves Delvet, who's also the founder of Synergism. So that's why you find that these two traditions are really the foundations of the Nazi ideology. And it goes back to the idea that the Aryan race and its mystical ideas have their origins in the Altay Mountains. So the Altay is fascinating for its place in this history. It's a place, it's where Russia, Mongolia, and China meet. And so it's believed that it's the shaman of, basically the shamanism of the Altay is the original religion of the Aryans. And so supposedly what happened is that it survived in Tibetan Buddhism. And that's why, according to Blavatsky, Tibetan Buddhism is really the best preservation of the Aryan mystical tradition. And so this is the idea. So this is what, and of course, again, like I mentioned earlier, these shamans were using drugs to contact the spirit world. So when you look at the Nazis or the people, the cult tradition influenced by them, this is what they were all trying to do. And so this goes as well with the Cernarchist. And so where you find a confluence of these elements is in occupied France, in Vichy France, which were basically collaborating with the Nazis. And there, this is where the Vichy regime is considered to have been a Cernarchist conspiracy, led by Jean Coutreau, who was the head of the Cernarchist Empire Movement, I think is what it was called. So he was a friend with Aldous Huxley, and both of them founded what's called the CSHP, the Center for the Study of Human Problems. And they founded that with Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, who was a Jesuit and evolutionist. And he's considered considered the leading influence behind the New Age movement and the patron saint of the internet. So in Vichy, France, this is where a lot of these Cernarchists were meeting with Nazis. So this is where Aldous Huxley was active as well, and people like Ernst Jünger. So Ernst Jünger is a leading figure. He is one of the most influential figures in the post-war right. One of the people who most inspired the post-war fascist right. And he is a leading exponent of what's called the German Conservative Revolution. And that is the movement that began, I believe, in the late 1800s and was the groundswell of conservative thought in Germany that ultimately led to the emergence of the Nazis. So linked to that is a group of conferences known as the Aranos Conferences. And that was founded by a woman, I always forget how to pronounce her name, but she was a friend of Alice Bailey. In fact, so she collaborated with Alice Bailey, effectively founded these conferences. They ultimately renamed them, and it became known as the Aranos Conferences. And that took place in Ascona in Switzerland, which is a very important occult location, really a confluence of all kinds of occult influences. And she did that in collaboration with Carl Jung. And Carl Jung, of course, during the war, worked very closely with Alan Dulles. And so out of these Aranos conferences, basically they were for the study of traditionalist ideas, a traditionalist understanding of history. A very important person there was Mirka Iliad, who was a member of the Ur group with Julius Evola, who is alongside Ernst Jünger. But instead you could say that Evola was the most important ideological influence in the post-war fascist right. And so Mirka Iliad is really the one who's responsible for this modern trend of called neo shamanism that became popular at the Esalen Institute in California. Now the Esalen Institute, as Kencher, was founded by Michael Murphy and Richard Price, and I can't remember which one of the two admitted it, but one of them openly admitted that the Esalen Institute was founded was modeled on the Aranos conferences. So there you have. So basically, Esalen inherits inherits the this project initiated by MK Ultra for the study of psychedelics, but more closely married to the occult and traditionalist outlook of history, where they pursued it for, you know, and more religious lines. And to come back to the point, earlier point, you know, the what's happened is that psychedelics have become popular again recently because there's the perceived, they have a perceived therapeutic value. A lot of people are going to South America for to use ayahuasca, which they believe, you know, can cure them of all kinds of ills. There's a study now at the Johns Hopkins. I think they're actually, maybe there's a couple of things. They're studying ayahuasca. In fact, they're inviting people to share their experiences of ayahuasca and their encounters with elves. So this is happening at a legitimate, you know, very well regarded university in the United States. And the study of magic mushrooms, because magic mushrooms as well are believed to be able to solve all kinds of problems, things like alcoholism. Now there's a study of a MDMA for treatment of PTSD and things like that. So there's always been this perception, or there's been a cultivated perception of psychedelics somehow associated with the left, mostly since the 60s, when it was associated with the anti-war movement. So there's this perception of drugs, psychedelics, contributing to mind expansion and usually to more liberal, anti-authoritarian, and more progressive outlook on the world. But, you know, recent studies are showing that if you look at the history of psychedelics, they went hand in hand with the development of the fascist right.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? The Huxley and his book The Doors of Perception was always recommended to anyone who was interested as a sort of almost a bit of gateway literature into psychedelics.
Yeah.
And he himself took LSD just before he died. In fact, he died on LSD. So, you know, but the thing is, most people think of Huxley as actually, and his particularly Brave New World, as actually being a warning. So, you know, what was he, you know, was he actually really into this kind of crazy world he was writing about in this famous dystopian novel, or not?
No, I think it's pretty, I think Aldous Huxley was one of, you know, if I may be allowed to say this, one of the most dishonest people in the 20th century. He was really the arch fiend of the 20th century. I mean, you know, you can look at the history of the occult and there's, you know, certain characters that stand out, like, you know, we talked about Blavatsky, Aleister Crowley, and, you know, even a person who's less well-known, like Edward Bulwer-Lytton, who's really the personality who really spearheaded the rise of the cult revival in the 19th century. But in our century, it was Aldous Huxley. And so, yes, this entire plot was largely his inspiration. And the Esalen Institute was founded under his inspiration as well.
I mean, I wonder whether, you know, this is his, like, sort of the writing of the novel. It's a little bit like Ian Fleming. I mean, he was involved in all sorts of really dodgy stuff during the Second World War, including treachery, actually. But, you know, he's kind of his catharsis is getting the novels out. So, you know, maybe Huxley was doing something like that. He realized that what he was doing was actually potentially really dangerous and dark. So this was his way of kind of saying, well, hey guys, maybe I'm not so 100% bad. He must have had a bit of a conscience, maybe. Yeah. But anyway, look, one of the other important institutions on the road to today is also the Stanford Research Institute.
Yeah. Yeah, so basically, there's a lot of detail to go through. So I'm not going to be able to, I'm afraid I'm going to be a little vague on some of them. But basically, MK Ultra later effectively evolved in what became known as Project Stargate. And Project Stargate, the purpose of it was to use psychics for what they call remote viewing. They thought they could use psychic for spying purposes. And it's curious there, a lot of those psychics were associated with the Church of Scientology. And another organization called IONS, which is the Institute for Noetic Sciences. And by noetic, they refer it into the noosphere, which is an idea that they derive from Teilhard de Chardin. and then linked to Stanford Research Institute, or SRI for short. So, and this is where, so I, like I mentioned, MKUltra grew out of the cybernetics group. And so the cybernetics group had a dual purpose or a dual mission. And so while they were exploring psychedelics, their goal, they began their project of creating artificial intelligence. So this is going back all the way to the late 40s, I think. And we've talked about this before, but that was their long-term goal. So to first create a personal computer, but then ultimately to create a computer that could achieve artificial intelligence. And so at SRI, that you get this meeting of, you know, the continuing exploration of psychedelics, and headed by people like Gregory Bateson, and who introduced a lot of people, important people, to psychedelics. I think he's the one who introduced who introduced Ken Kesey to psychedelics, who was the head of the Merry Pranksters. And sorry, am I getting that right? Who wrote the
he was the head of the Merry, yes, absolutely, yeah. Kesey was. Well, I mean, there, yeah, was the, there were these two sort of, one was a Timothy Leary and his kind of officialdom version, but Kesey is much, I think, you know, I kind of embrace Kesey, particularly with his One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. You see, he was almost like a kind of unofficial, you know, like unauthorized LSD research institute, yeah, kind of on a bus going around with people like Jack Kerouac and, you know, others, right, who've been involved in, yeah, the the Beat Generation from the 1950s, and, yeah, doing a almost a sort of an unofficial version or an unauthorized version of this research on the streets of San Francisco.
Yeah. So, I mean, what's interesting, so the whole Ken Kesey's book, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, is it's basically a representation of what's called anti-psychiatry. One of the founding figures, he had a couple of figures who were really important to it. One was Michel Foucault, right, the postmodernist, and the other was R.D. Lang, who was a British psychologist. And he was part of the whole swing in London scene, who were doing LSD. They also had a very interesting conference that they all participated in. And the title of the conference was the initials SOMA, or SOMA again. And I think it was called Dialectics of Liberation or something like that. They invited people like Stokely Carmichael of the Black Panthers, Angela Davis as well too. Which, anyway, that's a whole other chapter that I talk about, where you can see the whole confluence of the new left, psychedelics, and this field of anti-psychology and postmodernism. So this postmodernism is really what inspired the Esalen Institute. And again, it's founded on this idea of divine madness. So it's the idea that schizophrenics are not crazy. They're just on another level of reality. And the shamans too. So basically, when a shaman achieves a trance state, he's not crazy. He's just peering into the beyond, right? It's what they call a kind of divine madness, a term that goes all the way back to Plato. So that's what they were trying to achieve through psychedelics, was basically to replicate this kind of divine madness. So the idea was that these people are being put into institutions because they're perceived as being insane, when in fact they're geniuses of another kind. And so that's very much what inspired Esalen to continue their studies of psychedelics, and what came to be known as neo-shamanism.
Well, I think maybe we should take a musical break right now for Terry Hall and his song "The Lunatics Have Taken Over the Asylum," because that does. I mean, what you seem to be painting, David, and correct me if I'm wrong, is this desire to normalize these kind of schizophrenic experiences, whether it's through drugs or whether it's through serious mental illness, maybe you may call it demonic possession, to normalize this and to slowly over decades bring it out and normalize it. And I suppose it seems to me you're saying is that now this idea of normalizing this idea of psychedelic therapy, saying actually this could be really good for you, let's treat these people in hospital with this, it's slowly emerged as almost becoming a norm now.
Right. So they've been at it a long time, right? So I'm not sure. The thing is, there's some truth to it, that these drugs do seem to have some positive benefits. I think they're far too powerful to underestimate and to tamper with without better understanding. I think we're far, far, far from understanding how the human mind works. And to be using these substances, I think, irresponsibly. But regardless, I mean, that's why it's interesting how it comes back to Huxley's plan, right, of ultimately using some kind of drug to control populations. So I don't know if it's a pretext or if they partly believe it, but yeah, that's what they're trying to do. And what's interesting is, I want to get back to the point, because it comes back to this, that another person who was very fond of Gregory Bateson was Stuart Brand. And Stuart Brand, he's one of the most influential people behind the Silicon Valley computer culture, because he's considered really the one who inspired the use of the personal computer. I think we've talked about this before as well, too. So the idea that, you know, as I said, the computer was a project of the CIA originally, effectively Cybernetics Group, but they wanted to popularize its use, and they needed somehow to combat the perception that IBM was sort of the stodgy establishment corporation, and that tools were really something for engineers and not the average person. So they tried to sell, they did sell the computer as a tool of not just personal liberation, but political liberation, you know, a tool of almost revolution, which is why Steve Jobs' first famous commercial, 1984 commercial for the Macintosh, was of an athlete throwing a sledgehammer at the screen of Big Brother. So that somehow, you know, these computers, when they were going to get in the hands of the average person, were going to be able to, you're going to serve as a kind of tools for revolution and societal change.
Well, and, hang on, because yeah. Look, I mean, this is interesting. This, the parallel here, the idea is that you're going to be able to use your little PC in a revolutionary way in order to change the internet. Actually, no, the internet, as you start to look onto the online, the internet is coming into you, and it's a bit similar to the way that these people seem to want to use demonic forces as well. If you're conjuring up demons, those demons are likely to be, you think you're using them, and maybe two or three times, you know, you may get something from them, but suddenly you find yourself taken over, or there seems to be a parallel between those two, you know, with the computer networks and this, you know, demonic network. So maybe is that there? I mean, because, you know, for many of us, you know, all of us know and have seen the Frankenstein films. There's a kind of element of a kind of digital Frankenstein in AI, isn't there?
Yeah. So that's why Frankenstein is considered the model, right? If you look at, so this is how those twin tracks of psychedelics and computing merge in transhumanism, right? So, and this is conscious. So that's why you find most of the people who are the leaders. And today, this is what's happening, is that you find the push for the adoption of psychedelic therapy is coming from the right. One of the important funders is Rebecca Mercer, who is the daughter of Robert Mercer, who founded Cambridge Analytica with Steve Bannon. All three of them are members of the CNP, the Council for National Policy, which is basically the preeminent organization of the American right today. Another person who's linked with all of them is Peter Thiel. He's another now currently funding funding this psychedelic therapy movement. And he's the one, he's the first founder, first financial contributor to Facebook. He's also the founder of Palantir, which is the company, is a CIA-backed company that helped Cambridge Analytica breach Facebook data, which so that they could use to target audiences to favor Trump's election. Peter Thiel ended up working. And so Peter Thiel is also an advocate of Carl Schmitt. So Carl Schmitt is another person who is central to the conservative, German conservative revolution. He's known as the crown jurist of the Third Reich. But he was also friends with Leo Strauss, who is the godfather of the new conservative movement. So Albert Hofmann, after the war, he started palling around with various people on the right, and most importantly, the two people he's one of the two most important people he introduced LSD to. Well, maybe he didn't introduce LSD to Carl Schmitt, but he started communicating with Carl Schmitt and with Ernst Jünger. So this is why you see how this trend of, you know, the far right, even the neo-Nazi right, has been behind the scenes always, very closely associated with the psychedelics. And now, again, we come back to transhumanism. And I want to mention Nick Bostrom. He's the founder of the Transhumanist Society Association, something like that. And it's got renamed to Humanity Plus. And he wrote a book on the history of transhumanism. And he says it right there in the open. He says the origins of transhumanism go back to first the alchemists and then Shelley's Frankenstein. And because, again, it's a reference to the creation of life, which goes back again to Norbert Wiener's creation of Norbert Wiener, who's one of the two key figures in the cybernetics group. He wrote a book called God and Golem Inc. And he basically compared the creation of artificial intelligence to the creation of a Kabbalistic golem.
Well, this is a little bit worrying. It sounds like, you know, Terminator's all coming true, you know, in front of our eyes. But, yeah. You know, it's another thing about Peter Thiel is, I mean, okay, so he's just a Bilderberger. Anyone that follows the Bilderbergs like I do is quite regularly used to seeing him hanging around. But he also, there's an interesting article last year or a couple of years ago in Vanity Fair, saying that he wants to inject himself with young people's blood. He believes that, I mean, maybe he's been doing too much LSD, I don't know. He believes that by taking blood from young people and injecting it into him, that he can stop himself aging and cure himself. So, I mean, this is one of those very peculiar things from, what was it? The Queen's Necklace book by... Scott, was it? Maybe. Oh no, Dumas, I think. And this idea that you know, you can live forever. This is this big secret the occultists have got. Here's a way that you can inject yourself with something which is going to extend your life, and maybe, you know, you will never die. These are all the sorts of ideas these people play with. So exactly. Thiel, I mean, what do you make of this idea of? I mean, does it go back a long way? This idea of taking blood and using young people's blood. It sounds a bit bizarre to me.
I mean, drinking blood. Drinking blood is common in satanic rituals, right?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I find it amazing that the mainstream press doesn't pick up on these sorts of things, David, that, you know, someone who's the founder of PayPal, you know, which has taken over so many of our international and national transactions almost every day now out there is into this stuff. But so anyway, you talking about transhumanism, I think for some people they won't necessarily be familiar with exactly what the aims of the transhumanists are, and because they are very powerful people, but what are they actually after?
Well, I mean, simply put, their public image is that they want to improve humanity, augment humanity, right? So they want to use whatever technologies are available to improve humans, to make them live longer, to make them stronger, to make them, you know, more intelligent. So like things like smart drugs, nanotechnology, all kinds of things like that.
mRNA vaccines, maybe.
Yeah, and vaccines, presumably, yeah. And I would say that, you know, the way to best understand it is the best explanation that I've seen of what transhumanism is the movie Lucy with Scarlett Johansson. And Lucy has multiple meanings, right? Lucy is Lucy, which is the skeleton that what was his name? The archaeologist discovered. So Lucy is also when I think the Beatles, when they wrote their song "Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds," they made a reference. They were making an overt reference to Lucy, but also Lucy then stands for LSD, right? So. Basically, in the movie, she takes a smart drug until she becomes so intelligent that she can merge with the internet. And so that's kind of I find it hard to explain or understand, but this is how somehow these parallel paths are related to each other. But this is why they want to, you know, ultimately they want to create this global brain, which is knowingly compared to the all-seeing eye of Freemasonry, which is a computer that will be like a god because it will see everything and know everything. So it will be an artificial, very powerful artificial intelligence that will have access to the totality of human knowledge, as well as every activity, every transaction, where everything anywhere anyone is doing anywhere. And I can't explain how they see it, but they have this bizarre idea that they are going to be, because they think that the human mind is a biological computer,
right?
And so that it operates on a kind of program, so that the human personality is like a biological program, and that they will actually be able to replicate it and then sort of, you know, just toss it into an AI where it will live forever.
Well, look, you were talking about the archaeologists. It's Maurice Taieb, T-A-I-E-B, French geologist and paleoanthropologist, who discovered Lucy, which is supposedly Australopithecus skeleton. So
I thought it was S.B. Leakey.
Taieb, T-A-I-E-B. It's almost as if the technology isn't there for this, for the humans to embrace these computers, it's almost as if they're going to dose humans up with LSD in order right. to so that they think that it is. You know? Right. Yeah. Sort of try and use these hallucinogenics to program people.
Yeah.
But anyway, or maybe they're just deluded. But anyway, look, I mean, we can't leave off without mentioning my old friend Nick Land from school. Right. I was with at school from age sort of 14 to 16. Yeah. We were very good friends with him. Nick the Nazi, very, very knowledgeable guy. I'm not sure where he got all his knowledge from. It certainly wasn't from school. And, you know, you'll probably be thinking, well, why were you friends with a Nazi? Well, he was an incredibly knowledgeable guy. And I recognized that, you know, as a young man, lad, really. So, yeah, picked up a lot of knowledge from Nick when I was at school. But you see, he went on after school to Warwick University, became a professor there. He was a Nietzschean philosopher, which is Hitler's favorite philosophy. So, but he set up this thing called the Cybernetic Culture Research Unit, which has almost become a legend in the world of geeks and hackers and people like that. That Nick, back in the mid and early 1990s, was actually doing a lot of this stuff himself. It amazes me that he's been part of this same path, David. So can you just say something about Nick's role?
Yeah, so he's, I mean, first of all, I just want to know, like, I am not surprised that you would have found the guy, you know, curious or interesting, right? I mean, these guys can be geniuses. Unfortunately, they use their intelligence for the wrong things, whether they know it or not. But you should never really judge anybody, right? We judge their actions, but, you know, people are complex. But so he's considered the founder of accelerationism, which is, it goes back to the idea of accelerating the end times. So this is an idea which really goes back, it goes back a long way, but one of the organizations goes back to is the Process Church. And the Process Church, effectively what the process means is the process of causing acceleration of the end times, because it's called the Process Church of the Final Judgment, right? So it influenced Charles Manson, who carried out the Manson killings, as another, you know, way of creating mayhem to contribute to chaos, or what he thought was igniting a race war, which would help accelerate the end times. And so this is why accelerationism now has become popular with the various neo-Nazi terrorist movements that are emerging. So simultaneously, Nick also influenced what's called the Dark Enlightenment, and that's the movement, the Silicon Valley, it's called NRX, Neo Reaction. And it became popular in Silicon Valley, and Peter Thiel is one of its most popular proponents. It's basically
what Nick did is he actually authored something, I think it was in 2011, a manifesto basically called The Dark Enlightenment. Any idea what he really meant by that? I mean, I understand that the Freemasons back in the 18th century pushed something called the Enlightenment, which was all about not the church just taking the brakes off, letting people have a bit more free thinking, and also about the Industrial Revolution allowing all these inventions to be made. You know, obviously for a lot of people here in Britain, I don't know about elsewhere in the world, it was pretty horrific, the Industrial Revolution, the dark satanic mills and that kind of thing. So, but I mean, according to Nick, it seems that was the kind of light enlightenment, and now he wants a dark enlightenment, which that doesn't sound too good to me.
No. And I can't remember exactly what the details are, but from what I understand, it's basically it's opposed to the Age of Enlightenment, 18th century Enlightenment, which is characteristic of the fascist movement, right? That's this is where they lead off from the German conservative revolution, because that's what they were all about as well, right? So they look at the Enlightenment as being a tragedy because it introduced things like democracy, liberalism, egalitarianism, and things like that. So, which are all things which they consider antithetical to fascism.
Yeah, but I mean, Nick's manifesto is really about the idea of humans just giving up their freedoms and realizing that they can be, they're much better off just if they get told what to do by machines.
Okay. Yeah. I can't remember. But it's a kind of fascist technocracy or something like that.
I mean, see, it's almost as if existence then would have the soul totally sucked out of it, David.
Yeah. Well, it's the end time, right?
That's what maybe that's the point. Yeah, of course. And then the human spirit will fight back against that. And certain nations, almost certainly, if there are any independent nations left, will most definitely be fighting against that and seeing it as a threat to humanity rather like Hitler in the 1930s.
Yeah. Well, it's a movement against God, right? It always has been. This is just the modern manifestation of it. It's the same plot. They even like that said the transhumanist, the book, The History of Transhumanism, acknowledges it. They acknowledges that it's the history of the cult. They take it back, take it all the way back to Prometheus. And of course, there's a statue of Prometheus in front of Rockefeller Plaza Center. And so, it's a war. It's a Luciferian plot.
Well, I wonder if Nick is really as sold on it as he makes out, because one of the last conversations I had with him at school, we were aged about 18. I grabbed his arm, you know, as he was running up the stairs, and said to him, "Yeah, but does God exist or not, Nick? You know, you have been kind of hedging around these issues ever since I've known you." And he turned, he stopped, and he looked at me for a moment. And it's one of the things I love about the guy is he would not dodge issues. He would always address them. And he wouldn't try and kind of tiptoe around as these blasted politicians and journalists do all the time. And he said, it's about 50-50. So yeah. his plot to cancel God, maybe he's canceling half of himself. We'll see. Anyway, look, David, whereabouts can people find your research, and what's the title of this latest article on the fascists and drugs?
Right. So my latest book is called, it's a 6-volume work, which is called Ordo Ab Cal, and that's why my website is called ordoabcal.ca. There's a resource section there, which has all my latest articles. In fact, there's a block of recent articles on my homepage as well, too. You'll see my recent, it's called Fascism and Psychedelics, from the Conservative Revolution. I think it was Conservative Revolution to Esalen and Silicon Valley.
Just pat you on the back if I can be so patronizing, but thank you so much for putting that stuff out there for people to read. But if people really wanted to support you and actually find out more, it's quite simple, I believe, for people to get hold of your books, isn't it? Actually physical books.
Yeah.
So how do people buy those if they want to?
So my books are all available on Amazon. They get print or Kindle. Of course, you don't need a Kindle device to read Kindle. You can get the Kindle app on your phone or computer. And they can read it on my website. So my entire 6-volume set is published on my website as web pages.
Okay, David Livingston, as ever, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tony. Thanks as always. Always a pleasure.